From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Today, can MoviePass sustain its model of letting members visit theaters as often as once a day for just $10 a month? Then the movie Come Sunday is based on the true story of a Pentecostal bishop who has a spiritual crisis. It's directed by Joshua Marston.
I knew that I didn't want, in that scene where he's having an epiphany, to, for example, suddenly turn the camera upward and like show the ceiling opening up and clouds parting and the hand of God coming down and touching his finger. Like, there you could do that.
And Moses Sumney breaks down a track from his debut album. All that after this break. As a film reporter for many years, I know as well as anyone that seeing even just a couple of movies a month can be a very expensive habit. And that's why many film regulars are turning to MoviePass. It's a subscription-based app that charges users $9.95 a month to see as many as one movie every single day, at least at theater chains that accept the pass. Though the general public and some segments of show business have grown accustomed to subscription services like Netflix, Spotify, and Amazon, theater owners have not. To learn about how MoviePass is changing the film industry, I called up Variety's Brett Lang. He recently wrote the piece, The Great Disruptor, MoviePass Upends the Movie Business, but Can It Survive?
So MoviePass started in 2011, and at the time it was seen as a kind of niche offering that was about $30 to $50 a month, and it was really geared at frequent moviegoers who loved going to the movies and couldn't get enough of it. But they really took off last summer when MoviePass announced a new pricing program, and that was for $9.95 a month, people could go to a movie a day, and their subscriber count just massively expanded. It went from about 20,000 subscribers to more than 2 million and a really record pace. And so it's a company that had been around a while. It had struggled to gain traction and make much of an impression. But in the last year, it's really disrupted the movie business.
So if I understand the economics, I subscribe to MoviePass. I spend $10 a month on my pass. And when I go to the movie theater, MoviePass essentially buys the physical ticket from the theater. So if I go see 5 movies a month, and let's say it's, $10 a ticket, that's $50 out of MoviePass's pocket, and I'm only paying $10, how do they possibly make any money on a customer like me?
Well, that's the thing that's leaving a lot of people in Hollywood scratching their heads, because most businesses, you don't like to lose a lot of money on your customers, and MoviePass is essentially subsidizing movie going. But what they're saying is that they believe that the data that they collect on people is going to be of tremendous value to movie theaters or our movie studios. They believe that they can advertise against their user base, and they've already started to do that. 2 of the major 6 studios have started advertising with them. And they're also hoping that they will grow to such a great size that they'll get some kind of discount on tickets, some kind of wholesale price, or that they will essentially get a cut of the box office that they're responsible for, or more controversially, a cut of the concessions that they may eventually sell on their service.
One of our interns is a MoviePass user, but I also know a very prominent entertainment journalist who is a big believer in MoviePass. Is there a demographic that MoviePass is either identifying or seems to be kind of the average or typical customer?
They say that they skew younger, which makes total sense. And they say that they appeal to people who sort of grew up with a subscription model, who grew up using Netflix, who grew up using Spotify. That actually could be quite appealing to studios, because that's an audience that they're very dependent on, and it's also an audience that's very difficult to reach.
The major movie theater chains have not been embracing MoviePass completely, and AMC has been one of its biggest foes. What is AMC's argument against MoviePass?
Well, AMC has said that this is an unsustainable model and that they're essentially going to be left holding the bag when MoviePass goes bankrupt. But I think they also don't like the idea of a new business model being introduced to customers, because, like it or not, MoviePass has successfully introduced the idea of a subscription-based pricing to American moviegoers. And once something like that is introduced, particularly at a certain scale, it's very hard to take that away. the value of a ticket is, I don't know, in New York, it's something like $17 for me to go to a movie. Now, if I think to myself, actually, the value of going to the movies should be a monthly fee, and it's less than $10, that totally disrupts their business.
The other thing that you just raised is that if I am a MoviePass subscriber in New York and a movie ticket is maybe $17, there's an attraction in terms of the value of MoviePass. But let's say I live in South Dakota where a movie ticket might be $6. How does MoviePass sell its service where movie ticket prices are materially lower than they are in LA and New York?
Well, the answer is not as well. The bulk of their customers are in big cities with higher ticket prices. And MoviePass says that in order to be successful, they need to do two things. They need to attract more customers in the South and Midwest, where ticket prices are lower. And they also need to drive down usage. So it's almost like a gym membership, where a lot of people sign up for gym membership. They don't actually really use it. They believe that they can get usage down to a little over a movie a month, and that that will help them be profitable. They say they'll be profitable by 2019.
Even if movie theater exhibitors say this is a bad idea, aren't some emulating it? Isn't Cinemark trying to do something similar to MoviePass?
Yes, and in Europe, movie subscriptions are actually somewhat commonplace and have been introduced with success. So I think there is a growing awareness that, you know, whether it's how you access music, how you access ebooks, more and more people are turning to subscription services, and movie theaters don't want to miss out on that.
Brett Lang is senior film and media editor at Variety. He's the author of the cover story, The Great Disruptor, MoviePass Upends the Movie Business, But Can It Survive? Brent, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Appreciate it.
Coming up, a new movie looks at a real-life pastor's crisis of faith. A 2005 episode of This American Life told the story of Pentecostal Bishop Carlton Pearson. He was a protege of Oral Roberts and the leader of a megachurch in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where 6,000 people would worship on Sundays.
Well, the first time I ever cast the devil out of somebody, I was like 17 years old, 16 maybe. And the girl was my girlfriend.
This was a tiny storefront where the church was having a youth revival.
She just let out this scream, and it startled me and everybody else. She fell to the ground. I looked at the pastor, and he just stood there. And nobody else moved, so I started rebuking the devil.
But in 1994, Pearson had an epiphany that there was no hell and that people did not have to accept Jesus Christ and be saved to get into heaven. It was a direct repudiation of a fundamental teaching of the Pentecostal church, and it turned Pearson's life and his congregation upside down. The new Netflix movie Come Sunday is a fictionalized account of his life, starring Chiwetel Ejiofor as Pearson and Martin Sheen as Oral Roberts. The film was written by Marcus Hinchy and directed by Joshua Marston. I visited with them at the Sundance Film Festival after the film premiered there, and we began with what Marston knew about Pentecostalism going into the movie's production.
I was raised Jewish in Los Angeles, very reformed Jewish, and Judaism does not believe in hell and does not believe in the afterlife, depending on who you talk to. And so I think I was looking at this story from a more of an outsider perspective, saying, why do these folks so cling to the idea of hell? Why is it so important to them? That was one of the really animating questions for me intellectually. And what happens when you take hell away? But it meant that I knew very little about Pentecostalism. And as we got into it, I did a lot of reading, a lot of conversations with Carlton. And Carlton, I think, probably for both Marcus and for myself, was probably our first point of contact and our best teacher about what Pentecostals believe, how things work. And then at a certain point, I just started going to church. And for, I'd say, 3 or 4 months out before filming, wherever I was, whatever city I found myself in, I would send Carlton a text message and say, can you recommend a Pentecostal church in D.C. or Atlanta? And so I would go to church. And I think the one aspect of a Pentecostal service that most impressed me, weirdly, because I wasn't able to see like laying of hands necessarily or healing people, which Pentecostals also do, but every Pentecostal service, at a certain point, and it's usually the same point, has the members of the congregation turn and greet one another. It goes on for 5 or 10 minutes, and everyone walks around the room. And frequently, I was the only white person in the room. And it was really impressive to have 40 or 50 or 60 African-American Pentecostals walking up to me. Clearly, I didn't belong. Clearly, I was not a member of the church. No question about who I was. Embracing, literally, physically hugging me and saying that they were so happy to have me there. I mean, that's just one anecdote of discovering Pentecostalism. It was just really a fascinating journey.
So Carlton has an epiphany, and maybe it's a long time coming, but was there a triggering event?
So one night after he's back from one of his tours, he is putting his child to sleep and rocking her to sleep. And every night Carlton used to watch the news, the 6 o'clock news. And on this particular news broadcast, there was a TV special on the Hutus returning from Uganda to Rwanda. And the images of essentially Muslims and Catholics who were dying of malnutrition, dying of cholera in overcrowded camps, really touched something inside of him and led to a conversation with God. And very simply, that conversation was, how can you call yourself a loving and sovereign God and let these people suffer like this and then suck them all into hell? That was his crisis. And then the movie kind of goes from there.
All my life, I've been taught it. Everything I know points to a choice, heaven or hell. Many people I loved, members of my own family, went to hell, and they're there for good. Now, I could never reconcile that, but I do accept it because they had a choice. But when did these people in Africa separate from God? When did they make a choice? And how do they get saved? And he said they don't need to get saved. They're already saved.
So Joshua, Bishop Carlton has an epiphany. And his epiphany, to kind of shorten it into layman's terms, is that he no longer believes that God chooses who is saved and who isn't. That God sees the entire world as saved, and that individuals do not have to accept Jesus Christ as their personal savior, which is the tradition of his church, to get into heaven. That is his epiphany. When you are trying to tell the story of that part of his life, it seems cinematically challenging to tell the story of how somebody has a spiritual transformation. You can depict the outcome of that. You see people getting up and walking out of church. You see church equipment being auctioned off. There are physical manifestations of the impact of that. But how do you cinematically come up with a language to depict what he's going through in his crisis of faith or through his spiritual epiphany?
You know, there are various resources that you can deploy, whether it's the music or the cinematography or the camera placement or, you know, the performance. You know, it could be visual effects, it could be animation. I knew that I didn't want, in that scene where he's having an epiphany, to, for example, suddenly turn the camera upward and like show the ceiling opening up and clouds parting and the hand of God coming down and touching his, you know, like there, you could do that. That would be a cinematic choice. I, maybe because I am fairly secular, basically simply filmed him tussling, sort of, you know, muttering and writhing and a little bit of crying. And then we see, we hopefully get a sense that something has happened, right? And I use the music as well. In the edit room, I have to tell you that I came to question that a lot. That's a very specific filmmaking choice. You know, I'm someone who made Marie Full of Grace and The Forgiveness of Blood, which are very realist films where the camera doesn't impose itself and where we're simply observing. And it was an odd conversation to have with Chiwetel. What does it look like to have a conversation with God? And the first few takes, I was like, well, no, it's not that. And, you know, we finally found it. And then in the edit room, it was yet another level of how do I then use music and the editing and all in service of understanding what's going inside his head.
We're talking with Joshua Marston and Marcus Hinchey. Joshua is the director and Marcus is the writer of Come Sunday.
The God that we worship from the parts of this Bible that we focus on. That God is a monster. No, that, if we're really saying that God sends billions of people to burn in hell for eternity for missing the mark or missing the point or being born someplace else, well, that God is a monster. That God is worse than Hitler. That God is worse than Saddam Hussein. But that's not our God. That's not the God that we worship. No, that God loves us all.
It's important to point out that Carlton's great mentor and his great father figure is Oral Roberts. And Oral Roberts had transformed the church from, in the 1950s, being the traveling tent revivals to bringing it to television. But one of the largest things that he brought to the expression was racial inclusion. And so that clearly connects to his relationship with Carlton, who he saw as his spiritual son. But I think there was a time at the very beginning of all of this that Carlton believed that he was only taking inclusion one step, the natural step further, which was from racial inclusion to complete inclusion, and believed that the way Oral had been successful in carrying forward and expanding the church, that this was the natural next progression. And yes, it was ambitious, but ultimately, I think at the beginning, there was some belief that although it would be hard, he would be followed.
So much of your film is focused on, I think, his underestimating the impact that that is going to have on his congregation. Not that he wants to change his mind, because he believes that he has come to this decision through a spiritual way and that he has seen a light that he hasn't seen before. Does Carlton still feel that he underestimated the impact that this would have on his congregation, even though he still knows that he made the right choice?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the things that we talked about quite a lot, was that he really felt that he was mistaken in being so cavalier, and not cavalier is maybe the wrong word, but naive to think that people would just come along for the ride with him. And I think that's a testament to how genuinely he felt this change, that it was so crystal clear to him and so genuine that of course people would see it. And I realize that Unitarianism believes exactly what Carlton is preaching and has preached it for over 100 years. And so I suddenly had this realization that, wait a minute, all Carlton is effectively doing is changing denominations. But what he's doing is expecting his entire congregation to also change denomination. And that is ultimately very foolish.
Josh, great to see you.
Wonderful to be here.
Marcus, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Joshua Marston is the director, and Marcus Hinchey is the writer of Come Sunday. It's currently available on Netflix. And now, one of the many LA artists on the lineup at the Coachella Music Festival this year is singer and songwriter Moses Sumney. His first album, A Romanticism, came out last September, but before that, he'd already worked with an impressive and diverse list of collaborators, from Sufjan Stevens to Solange to Karen O of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs to Skrillex. The Los Angeles Times says Sumney's sound, quote, evokes the sensation of being in a float chamber, ethereal and dreamy, with stirring vocals. And that spirit is evident on Coral. It's the song that Sumney takes apart in this episode of Song Exploder. That's the podcast by our friend Hrishikesh Hirway, in which he sits down with a musician to deconstruct a particular song.
My name is Moses Sumney. When I was making my album, I was looking for a manager at the time. And one of the managers I was meeting was suggested, like, oh, you know, you should get in the studio with this guy, Cam Obi. We met for the first time and just talked about music for like 2 hours, playing each other stuff. And that inspired us to go out into the world and make something. He started making this beat. I started messing around on the guitar, just messing with a few chords. And Cam, he had a keyboard. He's a really great keyboard player. And he just started laying down this keyboard part. And we went back and forth on these four chords. the next time I remember working on the song is when I went on a cruise. I got a random email. I was just being like, hey, do you want to come on this TED Talk cruise for 7 days and sing two songs? So I went on this cruise where they got the top marine biologists in the world and the patrons who would fund their work to go on a trip across the Pacific Ocean and talk about oceans, which was like a really beautiful time, but also incredibly strange. It's just like surrounded by people who are just very different from me, you know, scientists and very, very rich people, because they would say some bizarre shit. They're true environmentalists. Like, we have to save the fish. We have to save the coral reef. And then at dinner time, they turn around and say, like, all the black people who do social work that I've come in touch with are, they're so out of touch, or like they're pushing for like racial rights, but we're all just one human race. So why are they trying to make things better for people of color when it's like they should be thinking about everybody, you know? That was pretty bizarre to me, just thinking like, oh, you could see the ways in which the environment is oppressed, but you can't see the ways in which other human beings are oppressed. That's when I started thinking about the like themes in the song. I was thinking about the distance between people of different social groups, and that's what inspired a lot of the tune. The song is about power. Looking back in my life at relationships that I had had with people from different backgrounds who saw us as equals and didn't realize that in the broader scope of the world, their perspective was appreciated on a wider scale, shared on a wider scale, and elevated. And so they were coming to the table with a social power that they were discounting in the personal relationship. So the song, essentially, Quarrel, is about the idea that you can't call a disagreement between two people simply a lover's quarrel, because that would imply that they are equals, and you have to recognize that we're not, that no two people come from the same background. And so I spent a lot of time just in my cabin writing and demoed a lot of the first vocal ideas. Don't call your lover's quarrel. I liked the kalimba sound, but I wanted to replace the kalimba sound with a harp. And then I started looking for a harp player. And then Cam, he remembered seeing this harp player on YouTube named Brandy Younger. And I looked her up on YouTube and instantly became obsessed. We just took a laptop and an interface and a hard drive and recorded her in her spare bedroom. And then a few weeks later, I assembled a band to play what became the outro of the song. There's Paris Strother on the keys. There was a different person on bass in that live trio, but I ended up replacing all of his bass with Thundercat. That's my favorite part. That was just a take of Thundercat, like, improvising. He hinted at that, and I stopped and was like, wait, that's the thing. I've always wanted to try to be a choir, a one-man choir. I spent a lot of time in solitude when making this album. So many people were a part of it, but I went away and wrote alone and tried to be as alone as possible. And when you're alone like that, you realize a lot about yourself, and you realize that you're not as simple, or at least I realized that about myself. And vocal arrangement became a way to communicate that I couldn't really just boil myself down to one thing.
You can hear a longer version of that session at songexploder.net. That's all we have for today. You can look for us on Twitter and Facebook. You will find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll be back here tomorrow.